This year is going to be a little bit different than all my previous shiurim, because instead of asking you to read and I've kind of preempted everything, I'm going to read and you're going to tell me what it means instead. I hope, otherwise it's going to be a very short shiur. So Parashat Vayeshev, let's just do a quick summary of Parashat Vayeshev, because it really deserves a whole series of shiurim on its own. There's so much in Vayeshev. And I think you can divide the parasha into four different stories, perhaps, although the first one is a very short story. Vayeshev starts with Yaakov living happily ever after. He's done all the hard work that he has to do in his life, and he just wants to sit and have a nice retirement. And that's the first couple of psukim. The second story in Vayeshev is Yosef and his dreams, and the brothers hating him and selling him, and that whole incident, which clearly is echoes of that going throughout all of Jewish history. The third story is Yehuda and Tamar. That's the bit that you skip in school when you're learning Parashat Vayeshev. Without going into too many details, Yehuda has three sons, Aaron, Onan, and Shelah, and he marries his son to Tamar, and Aaron dies, and Onan marries her, and he dies, and then she would like to marry Shelah, and Yehuda's getting a bit nervous by this point. So he kind of leaves her waiting, and then she dresses up as a prostitute, and Yehuda ends up having a child with her, and then without knowing it, and then she is nearly killed for being a lady of ill repute, and then Yehuda realizes it was his kid, and she has twins Zerah and Paretz, who become the progenitors of the royal family and also of prophetic line. So that's story number three, which is Yehuda and Tamar. And then the fourth story is the scene shifts to Egypt, and Yosef is in Egypt and he is sold to Potiphar, and then there's the incident with Potiphar and his wife, which you're familiar with from the musical, and then he's in jail with the butler and the baker, and then interprets their dreams. So those seem to be four very separate stories contained within the parasha, and each one of those has so much that can be said about it. What I would like to do is trying to find a theme that connects all four of these different stories together. Now, the obvious theme which connects them is dreams, right? That Yosef, in fact, not only dreams, it's always two dreams each time. Yosef has two dreams about the sun and the moon and about the sheaves of wheat. The butler and the baker have one dream each, which is two dreams together. And then in the following parasha, in Miketz, Paro has two dreams about the sheaves of wheat and the cow, which represent the 7 years. So there's this kind of idea, beginning and ending, of double dreams, which is an echo in the same way that Yosef's life is an echo of Yaakov's life. And Yaakov's life in Vayetze begins and ends with dreams as well. When he goes into exile, Yosef goes into exile. So you can definitely see a dream theme happening in the Parsha. But I would like to leave that one aside and try and look at something else based on Rabbeinu Bachaya. There's two Rabbeinu Bachayas. Don't get them confused. There's a Rabbeinu Bachaya who wrote a book called Chovot Levavot, The Duties of the Heart. That's Rabbeinu Bachaya Ibn Pekida. This is Rabbeinu Bachaya Ben Asher, who lived in Spain in the mid-14th century. He is a student of the Rashba, the Rashba was a student of Ramban. Rabbeinu Bachaya wrote a commentary on the whole of Chumash, and I suppose it's a little bit similar to Ramban in that he introduces a lot of Kabbalistic ideas, of which we're not going to look at any of them. He's one of the few who talks a little bit about Kabbalah, in the same way Ramban does, without going into too much detail. So he has a line-by-line commentary on the Chumash, which you won't find in your standard Mikraot Gedolot. What he also has for every parasha is a long introduction to the parasha. Based on a pasuk from Mishlei, he'll take something that Shlomo HaMelech said and then develop the theme of the parasha in this introduction. So I'd like to look at his introduction to Vayeshev and see if we can see the parasha through his introduction. So I'm going to read and translate this great, big, enormous, long paragraph, and that's after I cut out a few small pieces. I translate it on the next two pages, so you can either follow the Hebrew with me or read the English or whatever. And then I'd like to see if between us we can work out how that actually connects to the parsha and see where that takes us. So put your reading glasses on, and we will begin. So the verse he quotes from Mishle is, Al tigzal dal, do not steal from a poor person. Ki dalhu, because he is poor. V'al tadakeh ani b'sha'ar, and don't, I think King James says trample, crush, the poor person in the gate. Gate here probably means the stock market, I imagine, the exchange rate. Ki Hashem yariv rivam, because God will fight his fight for him. V'kava et kaveihem nafesh, and God will revenge, and that's the wrong word, how does that, despoil, whatever that fight is. Despoil their spiritual, I don't even know what that means, but I copied that from King James. So God will, don't pick on a poor person because God's going to be with him. That's the verse he's going to look at and interpret. Shlomo HaMelech Alav HaShalom, Hodienu B'Shnei Ketuvim Halalu, Onesh HaGozel Et Adav. Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, peace be upon him, made known to us in these two verses the punishment for stealing from a poor person. V'yadua ki dalet ki tot hen, shitira tor al ha'adam l'rachem otam, v'shor l'hara lehem. It's well known that there are four classes, four categories, four kinds of people that the Torah warns us particularly to be compassionate to them and to not do bad things to them. V'eluhem, and they are the following. Ani'im, poor people. Yitomim, orphans. Almanot, widows. And gerim, converts, or strangers. V'kein matzinu hakatuv, shetir al arba sam b'pasuk echad. We find a verse in the Torah that warns us about all these four categories of people in one verse. It says, in Devarim, V'samachti b'chagecha, you shall rejoice on your festival. Ata, you. Ubanecha, ubitcha, azacha, v'amasecha. Your son, your daughter, your male manservant, and your female servant. Four. V'halevi, v'hager, v'yatam, v'amana. And the levi, the convert, the orphan, and the widow. V'darshu razal, our rabbis have explained. It says, Arba sheli, k'neged arba shelcha. God says, there's four who are in my team, corresponding to the four in your team, in your family. Im atam esamech et sheli, if you take care of my people, then ani esamech et shelcha, I, God, will take care of your people. In other words, if you look after the levi, the ger, the atom, and the almanah, then I, God, will take care of your son, your daughter, your male servant, and your female servant. There's kir ha-levi k'neged ha-ni'im. It says levi, but that represents the poor people. The word levi is the representative of poor. Why? Shari levim, anim hem, levim are poor. Shelo hayalim chelek v'aretz. They didn't receive an inheritance, a portion in the land of Israel. So everybody else is self-sufficient and growing their own stuff. And the levim have to go around from place to place asking for a bit of maaser here and there and whatever they get. So, fine. Now, anim, we're going to look at these four different groups of people. He's going to, I think it's kind of an important message for us to remember anyway. But anyway, anim hem, she is here aleim atorah, b'mitzvot asei, or b'mitzvot lo tasei. The Torah warns us to take care of the poor in both positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvot. B'mitzvot asei, sh'nemar, it says in positive mitzvahs, natan titen, you shall certainly give to him. Patoach peftachet yadecha, open your hand. Mitzvot lo tasei, negative mitzvot, sh'nemar, v'lo yira levavcha v'titcha, you shouldn't be bad when your heart shouldn't feel bad when you give to him. And it says, lo tekbot et yadcha, don't close up your hand, don't close your fist when you're giving to him. The Achash HaTorah is here, Al HaGezel, Belav Shalot Tigzol, Mekol HaOlam. Since the Torah already forbade stealing, there's a prohibition of don't steal in the Torah, and that applies to everybody. Interesting, I wonder if he means to include non-Jews over here. Presumably he does. That's interesting. L'chach lai hutzracha la'athir al gezva'ani. Therefore, the Torah does not specifically say don't steal from a poor person, because a poor person is included within within the rest of the world. Not only that, but since you've got to give money to the poor person, so of course, how can you possibly justify stealing from a poor person when the money should be flowing the other way? And therefore, Shlomo HaMelech came and added on a new layer of detail to the standard mitzvah of don't steal, and specifically don't steal from the poor person. Now, why did he keep right? He ends our kol b'chol sefer mishnah lazkir mitzvah min ha-mitzvot ha-ktuvah b'torah. Because Shlomo doesn't just repeat a mitzvah that's stated in the Torah anyway, because what would he have to add? Elim ken yasif biur or yichadesh ba'davar, unless he has a new level of explanation or some new content. Kimi adam shi'avach rei Moshe in lo lasot siyag le'dvarav. Because who can come and add on to what Moshe Rabbeinu has already said, unless he's coming to add something else to the Torah? V'aken amar, therefore, Shlomo adds to the mitzvah of Moshe's don't steal. Shlomo adds al tigzal dal ki dalzo. Don't steal from a poor person because he is poor. En tarich lamar ledal. He doesn't need to say don't steal it from a poor person because it's even forbidden to steal from a rich person. So why does he mention poor? Marshes ki dal, the reason Shlomo mentions a poor person. Because a poor person is more likely to be stolen from, to be picked on and be stolen from. She'ain lo ozrim, because he hasn't got anyone to help him. Ve'ain mi shidaber ba'ado ke'ish ha'ashir, and he hasn't got advocates on his behalf, when like a rich person would have. Yes.
What are they stealing? I'm not understanding if he's a poor person, and what stealing are they talking about?
Whatever money he has, he's going to, is stolen from in lots of different ways.
But he's poor, right?
So the few pennies he's got are taken from him. I definitely agree with you, we're going to go there. I agree. But I do think it's true just on a very basic level that when there is, when the Royal Bank of Scotland goes bankrupt, it's the people who have a small current account are the ones are going to miss out, whereas the big businesses are going to be more protected and covered by legislation advocacy groups and other kinds of things on their behalf. When internet scammers are going around trying to get things from people, it's usually the poor, defenseless person who's not really able to defend themselves that's getting picked on more than others, I think. You can argue. But maybe theft is the wrong word, only breaking into his house and taking something out of his wallet, but just that
people take
advantage of somebody who, because they're poor and they know they can't take them to court and sue them for it and it's not worth their while doing this, whereas someone who's got more resources is going to be harder to... I think that's what he means on a simple level, and we're going to see on a spiritual level also, I hope. Well, you're going to help me understand that, because I'm not entirely sure where it's going to go. So therefore, the poor person has no one advocating on his behalf. But rather, everybody hates him. Sounds like a TV show. Everyone hates him, and they keep away from him. Even his relatives don't want to have anything to do with him because he's poor. Because it says in Mishlei, Kol achai rash sanuhu. All the brothers of the poor person hate him. Al ki merehu lasku mimenu. Even his relatives keep well away from him. Aken yamar. Therefore, Shlomo says, Al tigzol dal mitzad shu dal. Don't steal from the poor person because he's poor. Because you'll think he's an easy target. And that's a specific, and it's, apart from the general prohibition of stealing, don't pick on the easy target. Because the poor person's got no resources to fight back. And you know he's got no one else to speak up on his behalf. And no one to support him against you. No one will fight for him. So, don't think that that's the reality of the case. Even though that's what it looks like, don't think that. Ki HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yariv Rivo, because God will fight in his corner. V'hu HaTo'em Shalom, God will be the advocate for this
poor person, v'hu ya'anish et ha'gozim oto, and God will punish those who steal from him. Lo onish mamon, right, onish ha'guf ba'nefesh. Not, he won't punish them financially, but he will punish them physically and spiritually. And zeh, that's what it means, v'kava et kov'ehem nefesh, that God will despoil, whatever that means, with their soul. Shri mila kolel ha'guf ba'nefesh. That includes both physical and spiritual. And that's all these classes of people, a poor person, financially poor, and the other category, who have no one on their side. God will fight their fight for them and make sure things work out in the way they're supposed to. Yetamim v'almanot, widows and orphans, although orphans and widows, who shares hira alein haTorah ba'arbeh mekamot, the Torah in many places mentions them specifically to be nice to them. Kol almanah v'yotam lo ta'anun, don't afflict a widow or an orphan. V'dashu razal, afil almanato shel melech, afil yetamim shel melech. The rabbis tell us this means that even, it's not a financial poverty, but even the widow of a king or the children, the orphans of a king, even if they have money, you still can't, they're still defenseless in a sense. They're still lacking the resources to fight back, and therefore don't pick on them. V'atam, and the reason is, l'fi shenafsham shfela v'dimatam mitzuya, because they're spirit is low, they're depressed, and their tears can easily be aroused. The devamatuyu shakol marin umaanin otam, and it's common, it's frequent that people try and pick on these people because they are defenseless in a certain sense. Vamar katuv im anota ane otam, and the Torah says if you afflict them, you may not afflict them. Somebody else who gets picked on, taken advantage of, will have somebody to turn to defend them and to stand up for their rights. But an orphan and a widow, they have no one to save them. They've got no one to turn to but to God. Therefore God will hear their cries and will fight their fight. And the fourth category is Gerim, who shes hira alein haTorah v'harbeh mekamot. That's the Torah in many places. Convert. The word Gerim means both convert and stranger, and he uses them interchangeably over here. The Torah warns in many places about that. Who shekatuv, it says, v'ger lo toner v'lo tilchatzenu, do not oppress a convert or pressure him. Yes, hir shlo yoneh otov v'onat dvarim. You can't afflict him even with words. V'lo yilchatzenu b'gzeilat mamon, and don't pressure him with financial with theft. Ki gerim hiyitim b'eretz Mitzrayim, because you yourselves were strangers in the land of Egypt. Right? V'otziv tam hakatuv ha'acher, and there's another verse which adds another layer of meaning. Atem yadatim nefesh ager, you are familiar. You know the soul of the stranger. You know what it's like to be an outsider. So don't pick on a convert. Lama et ager, ela nefesh ager. It doesn't say you know the convert, but you know the soul of the convert. Kolama nafsho shvela, v'nichnat, v'einav tamid el Hashem. His soul is depressed and subjugated, and his eyes are always looking towards God to save him. He's always going to feel like a fish out of water and feel like an outsider, and therefore you need extra layers of protection for such a person. V'kein lo shirazal, the rabbis also said, hayav ben gerim, if there's somebody who's, even whose parents were converts. Lo yomar lo, don't say to him, Zachor mase avotecha, remember what your parents used to do? Right, all those non-Jewish things they used to do. Or I think it's also true of Baal Tshuva in the modern sense of the word. As well, I mean, anyone who feels outside the system. Baal ilmod Torah, if such a person comes to learn Torah, lo yomar lo, don't say to him, Pesha chal nevelot v'treifot shratim v'shramasim, a mouth that used to eat trace meat and creepy crawly things is now going to come and learn Torah that came from God's mouth. Right? Don't say that, obviously. Because you yourselves were strangers in the land of Egypt. The blemish which is your own blemish, don't point it out to somebody else. It's going to come back to you just as much. The Kei Matzino, he says, furthermore, we find that the tzadikim nekrim gerim, the righteous, are referred to as strangers, as converts. Right. Why? Lashon ger, milashon gargir. He says, Rebbe Bechaya says the word ger, stranger, convert, comes from the word gargir. A gargir is a crumb of bread or a kernel of wheat. A small thing that falls off a bigger thing. Right? Milashon gargir, hanifrad meikara, which is separated from where it's supposed to be, from where it starts off. It is a poor little crumb all by itself, and the loaf of bread is sitting over there. That's how a convert feels, that's how a stranger feels, and that's how a tzaddik feels. Kena tzaddik ro'et asmo yichidi. A tzaddik sees himself as alone, or as a loner, I suppose. Ein dirata ba'eretz ki im dirat arai. His living in the land is only a temporary dwelling. V'zeh shemad David alav hashalom, King David said, Ger anochi ba'eretz al taster mimeni mitzvotecha. David says, I am a stranger in the land. Don't hide your mitzvahs from me. Stranger. What does that mean? Himshilat maligir. David likened himself to a stranger, a convert. Shumizuman nesia ve'enodeh ha'et. He's at all times has to be ready to go off on a journey. He doesn't know where he's going to be tomorrow. And he's got to always be prepared. Lefish enodeh ha'et. Vultrech shikat tzedal adert. He's got to always carry around a suitcase with him in case tomorrow he's going to have to pack his bags and go, he wants to be really packed and on his way. And what is the provisions that a person has to take for them? Right? Kiyum mitzvot. It's the mitzvot that they do. Those are the provisions for Olam Haba. Zeh, that's why he says, Al tastem imenu mitzvotecha. That's why David says to God, don't hide your mitzvot from me. That's what I need. That's all I can hang on to. That's the only thing I've got, because who knows from today to tomorrow what's going to happen. And we find that all of the patriarchs were called Gerim also. Avram, Ushakatuv, I know he's cheating a little bit, but the message is a very deep one. Avram, it says, Ger v'toshav anochi en lachem. Avram says to Bnei Chet, when he's coming to bury his wife, I am a ger, a stranger and a sojourner amongst you. Yitzchak, that Yitzchak, it says, God says to Yitzchak, Gur ba'aretz hazot, live in this land. But the word Gur means it's a temporary thing. And Yaakov, that's a typo. I don't know what's supposed to be there. It says, "Vayeshev Yaakov eretz migurei aviv, eretz Canaan." He lives in the land of the ger, where his parents were strangers in the land of Canaan. And then Rebbeinu Bechai begins his commentary of Vayeshev. Okay, that's nice. Don't steal from poor people. Don't be mean to widows and orphans. And don't pick on people who are outside of the community. Those are all really nice ideas, but, as the leader said, there must be some kind of spiritual message here, and there must be something deeper than that, and something more connected to the parasha. So, well, I guess, does anyone have any suggestions of how this connects to the parasha? Apart from the very first line, where it says, Yaakov lived in the land of his fathers. I'll take that as a no. So, I was thinking that there's four categories of people here, and there's four different stories in the parasha. I was wondering if we can match up the four people to the four stories. And go a step further than that, see how one of these poor people was picked on in the parasha, and how God arranged things so that they got their just reward at the end of the story. That seems to me like a possible way of understanding Rebbeinu Bechaya. So I'll go first and say first one, and then we have to work out the other three. Yaakov is the ger. Because he tells us that. He says explicitly, Yaakov is the ger, Yaakov is the stranger. He's living in a land, even though he's living in a land that's been promised to him by God, and the brach has been passed down from Abraham to Yitzchak to Yaakov, but it's still not his land. He's living there as a stranger, as an outsider. He's always worried about the people around, what they're going to say and think and do to him. And therefore, he is very much part of an outsider, and as a tzaddik also, he's very much on his own. That's how he began. That's a given, because Rebbeinu Chaya says that. And I think this parasha lays down the framework which is going to lead to the exile in Egypt, and then the redemption from that to come back to Israel, where Yaakov and Yisrael is going to be, have a permanent home, and be not strangers, but be
the Balabite in the land as much as the land that God gives them. In other words, this parasha, I suppose everything, just like Mashiach is always coming. So everything in the Chumash sets in motion the exile and the redemption. But I think we can, you know, the Midrash says, for the few pennies of cloth that Yaakov gave to Yosef, the coat, the Kotot Pasim, one thing happened after another, and that led to our ancestors going down to Egypt. There's this parasha, the brothers' jealousy, and so everything in this parasha, beginning with Yaakov just trying to have a nice retirement and take things easy. Right, that's when everything began. We're finished with the Avot, in a sense. The Avot did what they had to do. Now we're starting with the story of the children, and that's what's going to lead to exile and redemption. So that's Yaakov, who is the Ger, and God takes care of things in the long term to see that we're no longer Gerim, but we can, as much as we can have any kind of permanence anywhere, that we get the land of Israel that we're promised. Now, over to you to match up the other three categories, the other three stories in the chart.
I guess the widow's bit might be smart.
Okay.
So she is a widow.
Okay, good.
Lots of time.
Do you have something to say on what I said? Or are you gonna?
Just before we move on to the next category, one could argue that yes, Raphael is there, and he wants to go down to the fire, and that God takes care of him.
Yes, I definitely, I agree. And the problem of doing this is, I suppose, anyone could be anyone here, and there's no real definite answer. The reason I've gone with Yaakov is twofold. One is he says it, and secondly, I want to use Yosef for something else. But I take your point. I mean, they could all be Yosef, not the widow, I suppose. They're all Yosef, in a sense. But notwithstanding that, I'd like to just try and break it up into four different stories. Sorry, Lee, so you think Tamar is the widow?
Yes.
What was stolen from her?
Actually,
you know what? Let's try and do it. Okay. Who is the orphan and who is the poor person?
Orphan.
Why?
Family.
And because his mother's dead. Right, so Yosef is the orphan. Literally is an orphan.
Right.
His mother's, when his baby brother was born, his mother died.
Right.
He's on his own. There's the other 10 tribes, 10 brothers, but they're all doing their own thing. And Yosef is the orphan, the outsider within the family. Before he starts having the streets, everyone hates him. He's very much on his own. It says in the Chumash, who now is Bnei Bilhah, but Bnei Bilhah is hanging out with the children of the concubines, as it were, because he doesn't have a mother. He doesn't have, even though his mother was the main wife at one point in Yaakov's life, but now he's an orphan, and he's therefore all of these ideas of the vulnerability. Even though he's got the father, even though he's the favourite child, even though he's got an extra coat that nobody else has, and even though he's got a musical written about him, despite all of that, he's still at core, he's an orphan, and he's always, that's part of the story. So what was stolen from Yosef? When it says don't steal from the poor person, which includes these poor, what was stolen from Yaakov? His living in Israel was stolen from him. He was in exile and then came back to him. So what was stolen from Yosef?
His freedom.
His freedom.
His
honor. His passed him. Well, I suppose what was stolen from Yaakov was Yosef. That's the truth of the matter. And Yosef represented Yaakov's future. Yosef was Yaakov. Yaakov saw himself in Yosef. The Midrash has many parallels between the life of Yosef and the life of Yaakov, but Yaakov favored him because he saw his own life in that of Yosef, and he's the son of the favorite wife and all those other things. But it's also, and in addition, Yaakov had a prophecy that if all of his 12 sons would continue his path, then he would get Olam Haba. But if they didn't all continue his path, then he'd lose Olam Haba. So if Yosef disappears, if Yosef's not there, then he's not only losing his present, his future in the physical world, he's losing his Olam Haba as well, in a sense. And that was taken away from him. And then was ultimately given back when they come to Egypt, and he meets Yosef again and sees
all of, and then he sees what's become of Yosef, let's give him back to him, and then the long term is. So what was taken from Yosef, his freedom was taken away from him, was sold to the slavery. His coat was taken away from him. What else?
His heritage.
Yaakov was taken away from Yosef. He's taken away from Yaakov.
Meaning, like, since Yosef was tempted by the, Potiphar's wife, all that, he had to hold on to something from his past because Judaism wasn't surrounding him at all. His values weren't surrounding him.
Okay, good. So his culture and heritage were taken from him. Good.
Did he stop having dreams?
His dreams were taken away from him.
Really?
In a sense. Well, they weren't, because he hung on to them. But they tried to steal them. Why did they sell him? Because they wanted to get rid of the dream and the dreamer. Yosef's dream is that he's going to be the king. Everyone's going to bow down to him. He's the hero. And the brothers wanted to kill him and then sold him to make sure those dreams didn't come true. And it's true that Yosef hung on to those dreams. And Yosef was always waiting to see. And so was Yaakov, according to Rashi's explanation of Aviv Shemar Tadavah. But Yosef had this vision, had this dream, and the brothers were trying to take that away from him. And of course, Yosef came out because of his dreams, and dreams got him out of it, and he did end up ruling the world, and all became true because he hung on to those dreams. But that's what the brothers were trying to take away from him. And in a sense, that's also his future, because that's what he knew he had to be and had to do. And the brothers were trying to get rid of that, to kill that physically and spiritually. I think that's what they're trying to steal from him. And there was no one there to stand up in his defense. Benjamin wasn't there. Even it's true that Reuben spoke up and tried to save him. There wasn't even no advocates. But even so, Reuben was sidelined, and there was no one there to look out for him and send out the search parties. And even God had to sign on with the brothers in the pact, not tell Yaakov where Yosef was, according to the Gemara. So I think that's what was.
What, so the story would come to
fruition? The brothers made a, they got a minion together, and they made a neder that no one was allowed to tell Yaakov what really happened to Yosef. But there were only 9 brothers left. Yosef was sold, Benjamin was at home, and Reuben had gone off to do his thing, which is why they sold Yosef when Reuben wasn't around. They only had 9. So the Gemara says that they included God in their minion, so that God wouldn't tell Yaakov through prophecy what had really happened to Yosef.
Isn't there a prophet, like
a prophet
considered to be
one of the 10?
Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe. Maybe. And that's why he didn't tell Yaakov even when he was in Egypt.
Yeah.
Nice idea. Okay, I hear that. So, interestingly, the 10 martyrs that we read about on Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av, who were killed by the Romans, are seen as payback for the 10 brothers who sold Yosef. This, historically, it wasn't all the same people at the same time, whatever, but the message of the 10 martyrs is to make up for the sin of the 10 brothers. I think it should be up to Kamenetsky says that there were only 9 brothers. And God. And there were 10 martyrs. So somebody's standing into God over here. And there's a Gemara in a couple of places in Shas about Shimon HaPikuli, I think is his name, who used to learn something from all of the word et in the Torah. Et HaShemayim Ve'et Ha'aretz comes to include all of the subcategories of earth and subcategories of heaven. Et Kabed Et Avicha Ve'et Imecha comes to include older brothers and older sisters. The word et, he used to go through and learn everything through the Quran, until he came to the verse that says, Et Hashem Elokecha Tirah. You must fear God. And then he said, I can't make it. There's nothing that can be a subcategory of God. There's nothing I can learn from this. And therefore,
famously said, "Kshem shekibal mischal adrisha, kach shekibal mischal aprisha." He said everything he'd said because he couldn't make it all fit into the system. And then the Gemara says, until Rabbi Akiva came along and said, "Et Hashem lakecha comes to include Talmidei Chachamim." You've got to have the same. No, I think it was Rabbi Yaakov, but I'm not positive. Said, how can Rabbi Akiva have the audacity to say such a thing? I mean, how can you compare a Talmid Chacham to God? It's not like a subcategory or anything like that. And he says the answer is because Rabbi Akiva was the martyr of the stand-in for God in the 10 martyrs. That he was able to say, because he made himself a subcategory of that, therefore he was able to stand in and be, when he was killed, that was, and he was the Torah Shabbal Pan, he was the, whatever, and aside. So the, So the 10 brothers, or the 9 brothers, and Yaak and God, or and Yosef, took from Yosef more than just his freedom, because and more than just his coat, but his whole future and his dreams and everything. They're trying to steal that from him, and God came and advocated on his behalf, and made sure that everything turned out as it was supposed to. No? Yes? Okay. Next. Story.
Just like feels like it's conflicting a bit if you're saying that Hashem was one of the million and he advocated on his behalf.
He was one of the million in terms of not telling Yaakov.
Mm-hmm.
But that was part of that. That it, the whole story only worked out because Yaakov didn't know.
Right.
So that's not necessarily contradiction to the advocacy, I think.
Well, how can they delegate Hashem to be
nice?
We're
improving you with this.
I don't know.
I know people tried. but you understand the idea of the Midrash,
yeah.
not that literally.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what it means.
Right.
Literally, but I understand the concept there that this is a necessary thing. The third category is the widow. Lee, you want to claim that's Tamar?
Yes.
Why?
Because her husband's died.
Right. Good.
And then she ends up being the then maybe that's her looking after and making sure she gets the reward.
So what was taken from her?
Her ability to have children.
Okay.
Because I don't remember which brother. Well, yeah, because one of the brothers, they like sold their seed or something like that, and also Yehuda wouldn't let her marry one of his sons,
mm-hmm.
so she wasn't able to have children.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a child, she's a person without children, sort of like dead, kind of, so that is a big deal.
Do you think not only was he withholding a husband from her, but he was withholding children from her as well? Right. And therefore the reward that she had twins at the end.
Yes, and also that she's down the that comes from her.
Right, so I would go even a step further. It's not only children, which is a short-term goal, in a sense, but I mean, I don't know if she thought or not, but why did she want to be part of Yehuda's family? Because she wants to be part of the royal family. She wanted to have children who were kings, and she was prepared to risk her life for that. Right, I mean, she first gave up her dignity and her anything else that she self-esteem and everything else in order to trick Yehuda and to become pregnant through him. But if you look at in the Chumash, right, they see that she's pregnant, and Yehuda convenes a Beis Din to try her for being promiscuous, even though he's stopped her, he's cut off any kind of options from her, and then punishes her when she seems to be doing this, when there's no options left, which is itself interesting. And on that basis, there's Yehuda and Yaakov and Yitzchak, presumably. Right. And she could have at any time said, "Well, what do you want from me? It's your kid." But she doesn't say anything. She just gives Yehuda a clue that allows him to admit that it's him if he wants to. And the Gemara says she was prepared to be killed rather than embarrass Yehuda. And all of that, and then Yehuda says, "Tzadka mimeni," which is either "Tzadka, she's right, mimeni, it's from me, it's my kid," or "Tzadka mimeni, she's more right just to me, she's right and I'm wrong."
And so what he was trying to take was her whole, was not only her as an individual now, which is true, there's no husband and no child and no, you know, anything. And we want children to look after us in our old age and push us around in wheelchairs when we get to that stage in our life. But it's the whole future of the Jewish people, which she saw herself as part of. In the same way that Ruth saw herself as being part of that family, part of that thing, which had to risk everything in order to follow that dream and that ideal. And that was, Yehuda tried to take that away from her. And she had no one on her behalf. And God arranged things so that she would be able to fulfill that vision and that long-term goal that she had.
Right.
Where does he come from?
And whose son is
Yaakov and Leah. He's the fourth son of Yaakov and Leah.
Ah, okay.
He is the, so why is he not, why is Reuben, who's the oldest, should be the king? Because he's the oldest, but because, it became clear after last week's parsha that Yehuda was going to be the leader. And we'll find in Vayigash, and even in Miket, Yehuda is the leader, is the king. And Yehuda was the one who sold Yosef. It was his idea to sell Yosef. And he's held most accountable for that. And more than that, the whole future of the Jewish people is described in the prophet as Yehuda and Yosef. So the division between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Yehuda is the division between Yehuda and Yosef. And the vision for the ultimate, it's the Mashiach, is that those two all unite. And become one thing. So Yehuda represents not kingship, but also the one whole branch of the Jewish people, as opposed to the Yosef approach. I'm going off on a tangent now, but I saw something this week on Parsha Blog, which is a blog by a guy called Josh Waxman, who I don't know personally, but he always writes good stuff. And he addresses a question that's been bothering me for a very long time, although I'm not sure whether the answer is actually kosher or not, but the question has been bothering me for a long time. It probably bothers you as well. Which is, Er died. Er is Yehuda's oldest son, died, and Yehuda says to Onan, he should then marry Tamar. Why did he do that? Because of the concept of Yibum. Right. The concept of Yibum means that if a man dies without children, his brother steps in and he gets all that, the children, the future, all that other, and his name, that's all the same vision. So Onan steps in then to be in place of his brother. Onan dies, so Shelah should be the next in line. Yehuda says no. So then Tamar has a relationship with Yehuda. Now how did the father, there's no halacha in the Torah. The concept of Yibum is between brothers. It doesn't say go to the father. If there's no more brothers around, or if the other brothers, why is Tamar going to Yehuda? Why is that part of the equation? How's that? Right, so I mean, the simple answer is the Torah wasn't given yet. There was no halakha of Yibum yet, and Tamar wasn't interested in the Shulchan Aruch. She was interested in being part of the mother of the royal family. Josh Waxman found a book which says that there was an ancient Hittite custom of, if somebody died without children, either the brother or the father would marry that wife, so there'd be children from them. So that there are parallels between what they were doing may have been what the local minhag was, independent of the halacha, or which connects similar to Jewish halacha, but a separate thing. And I suppose Tamar, coming from a different culture, may have seen that as part of the same thing and the same basic concept of this halacha. Is from the same family in the same. I think that doesn't help at all to explain Ruth and Boaz, which is a separate problem because there it's not a brother and it's an uncle or cousin or whatever it is, which is a separate issue. That's after Torah's given. I'm not going to go there. But anyway, so coming back to Rebbeinu Bechaya's vision of view of Vayeshev, the story where we've got Yaakov, whose future is taken from him when the whole events unfold and Yosef is taken away. Yosef's future is taken from him when they try and kill his dream by killing him or selling him. Tamar's future is taken from her when Yehuda withholds Shelah and then when he tries to kill her in Basin. So far it's easy. Now it gets tricky. The fourth category of Rebbeinu Bechaya is a poor person.
And Aviva said there must be something deeper than just having no money, and I agree. But who's the poor person over here? And what was taken from them, and how did God pay them back? I'll be honest, I don't really. I've been thinking about this all day, and I haven't got a clear answer, so I'm very happy, eagerly awaiting your answers to this question. I do have an idea.
Like, who's left? There are four parts, right?
Right.
So the fourth,
Is Yosef in Egypt. But which means Yosef and Potiphar, Yosef and Potiphar's wife, Yosef and the jailer in jail, and Yosef and the dreams of the butcher, of the baker and the candlestick maker, of the butler and the baker. If I'm right, if everything I've said to now is right, which it may not be, but if it is, and it works so well that I think it might be, then I'm stuck with this last bit, of who's the poor person over here?
You mean poor literally, right?
Don't know. I'm not. If you can give me a good answer and explain it without literally, then I'll take that as well. Lee?
Well, it could be the officer again when he's in jail, and that doesn't he interprets the dreams of the butler and baker, and then they kind of get released and go off, and then they forget about him. So that could be the stealing from the poor, I guess.
Okay, good answer. Right, good answer. So Yosef interprets the butler's dream as his remembrance of Paro, and then he forgets him and doesn't remember him, and Yosef spends another 2 years in jail as a result of that. And he was poor because he was a slave and he was in jail, and he's at the bottom of the heap in every possible way. Good answer. Good answer. And it's probably the right answer. I don't like it because it's Yosef again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing again. It's not really different in any way than Yosef's dream from before. It's just the name of the same thing. So it sounds like it should be right.
Well, I kind of see the same person.
Yeah, it can be. It's just not really four categories. Then it's just, well, I guess it's him as an orphan with his brothers, and then him as a poor person in Egypt without any family around him at all. Okay. It's a good answer. And I didn't really think of it until you said it, and having heard you say it, I think I like it, and I think it's it probably is the right answer. But is there any other answers?
This other one is not exactly like it's angry and stressing.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
When Tamar was on trial, I didn't read the whole question. It's in the question, right?
Yes, yeah.
So as a result of her, she's cornered. Meaning that she doesn't have her way out is the
stuff. And the signet ring. Yeah.
Yeah. But she's even like a poor person because she doesn't have any, like the way that he describes this, the way a poor person is defenseless.
Mm-hmm.
So she also is because she doesn't have anything stuck.
Right.
So that's my only way of connecting.
Good. Except that she's also the widow.
Well, I know.
But there's no problem with that. It's also a good answer. I agree. Good answer.
Hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Lee.
No, I take it back.
What?
I was just thinking along the lines of Reuben, because he's already kind of in trouble because of doing the whole bid switchy incident. And one of the suggestions as to why he was like not with the brothers because he was busy doing a not mourning, but like...
Doing tshuva.
Yeah, tshuva. And then he, because of maybe this incident, or partly to do with it, he loses his being the...
Right.
His birthright, kind of thing. But I don't know why he was poor.
Good, I like it. Nice. Any other suggestions?
I'm
making this whole thing up.
Rabbi
Rechaya gives us this and then walks away and leaves us to figure it out. And I'm trying to figure it out, and that's how I understand it.
But the fact that he's bringing in parallels meaning that he's expecting us to compare.
That's what I think. But if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. But I think the first three examples do fit so well. That I'd really like to find a fourth one that fits in with these.
This is probably a bit ridiculous.
Yes.
But
terms of the orphan, in theory it could have been the unborn twins of the mom.
Okay.
Because had she not been put in the position that she was in, or had she, had the story not unfolded the way it was, then these children who eventually were to, you know, bring forth the land of Shiachos wouldn't have been born.
So therefore they're the orphans, and Yosef can be the poor person.
Right, and Yosef can never be the poor person because the orphans.
Okay.
But, I mean, they're not technically orphans born. But, you know, maybe like as they're loitering in the higher world waiting to come down for a while, they were.
Okay, good. Good. Aviva.
I'm working on it.
Hey.
I don't know what I think of the same.
So here, let me, here's actually, before I say that much, while you're getting the popcorn, just something that I saw, while you're thinking, here's a tangent, just at least you have something which is more real than us collaborating here. Although maybe that's more real, I'm not sure. Anyway, a lot of Rishonim ask the following question, which is such an obvious question that I'm kind of kicking myself that I never thought of it, which is, and again, this is nothing to do with what I've talked about until now, I'm just giving you time to think while I'm talking about this on a tangent, which is the following, that the butler has a dream of three branches of grapes growing off the vine with grapes in them, and he's going to squeeze the grapes into Pharaoh's cup, right? So over there, the three vines represent. How does Yosef interpret the dream? Three vines, three days.
5 days.
In three more days, Sarah's going to call you back to your position and whatever, yeah? That's three vines growing off a single vine, represent 3 days. In next week's Parsha, which you haven't seen for 51 weeks, I'm not saying to know it, but Pharaoh has a dream. Pharaoh has a dream, he has two dreams, but one of the dreams is about a stalk of wheat that grows seven different sheaves of wheat from it. And Yosef interprets that dream, and over there it's seven years. So Tosfot, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, all ask the question, how come over here it means days, and over there it means years? Surely it should be the same, I mean, something growing off something else with a number must, in the rules of dream interpretation must mean the same thing, surely. Right. And
what was growing?
So Tosfot actually goes, right, so Tosfot says, clearly you can't have a famine of 7 days, that would be a silly famine. Mm-hmm. So it must be 7 years. But then why does the baker and the butler, why don't they get seven more years? Three more years. Why is it 3 days for them? And he says, maybe you'll say that no one ever spent 3 years in prison, so therefore it must be 3 days. It's not true, because Yosef wasn't there for more than 3 years. And maybe you'll say because it was the branches all growing off the same vine, but that's exactly the same thing that happens in the Pharaoh's dream with the wheat as well, it's all growing off the same vine. And he goes through all sorts of different things that you might want to say that don't work. I don't know. I knew both those stories, and I just never thought about that question. Which
maybe because one is fruit,
grain, maybe, but yeah, okay. So Tosfot and Rush and Ibn Ezra both are forced to say what I think is quite a weak answer, although perhaps it's a dream interpretation, which is they both say that Yosef must have known that it was Pharaoh's birthday in 3 days' time, and that when he has his birthday, he usually gives pardons on his birthday, and therefore it made sense there would be 3 days over there. Whereas the famine has to be 7 years because the famine can't be anything other than years. It's not really a dream. It means that the interpretation of the dream is not actually inside the dream.
Right.
It's external information that he's using to, which is a weak, yes.
But anyway, we sort of can extrapolate that it's external because when Yosef asked to interpret the dreams, he says, not me, it's Hashem. So either he's just being modest, or it could be really like Hashem tells him that it's 3 years or 3 days.
So Tosfot thought of that as well. Yeah. I forgot to mention. So Tosfot said maybe it's prophecy. Mm-hmm. From the Gemara and Brachot learn that that the dream follows the interpretation. Meaning what the meaning of the dream is follows the interpretation, learns it from Yosef interpreting the dream of the butler. Meaning it sounds from the Gemara as though the meaning is inside the dream, rather than you just have to have prophecy which tells the answer to something else. So Tosafot doesn't like the eight. Yeah, I'm sure you're right, but Tosafot doesn't like that answer either. And that's why he says that it must be, he just knew about this birthday party happening in the future. Which I don't think Tosafot likes that answer either very much. Ibn Ezra gives the same answer. Rambam and Rashbam reject that, says that you don't have to say that answer. And he wants to say, kind of like you were saying, the fact that it's fruit, the fact that the Torah uses words to describe the fruit is ripe and ready to be eaten and waiting to be squeezed. That implies it's very immediate. Whereas the grain somehow represents a longer term thing. So in the words that they find meaning in those words over there. Okay, I don't find that question. I'm just kicking myself. I never thought of that question before because it's so off. That's not the question. Right, now you've had time to think. Who's the poor person?
I'm
still voting. You're still voting. I think I'm going to vote with you as well, but I want to hear some alternatives.
Okay, so maybe, just as a general point, I think that when you hear all the stories, they're all like poor people in a way. Like Yaakov had a very sad life, a very difficult life, and we end the parsha with him mourning about losing his son. Tamar's story is very tragic, along with Yehuda's reputation and what Yehuda stood for, and him also having the struggle within him, I feel, was having Yosef have, you know, he knowing that this struggle is going to become out of the one nation becoming two, and a, you know, just an internal struggle for him to figure out how to, you know, alleviate the situation. And then Yosef being sold is on one side, you know, tragic from him losing his part in his family structure, and him going to another country, him becoming, like they say, he became, you know, very Egyptian at that point. So I think that in general, like all four of these characters, or all five of them, are very tragic. And maybe,
but the themes as well. Yeah. The redemptive quality at the end. But,
well, yeah. Of course, that's why
point is,
right?
Exactly.
Is
yeah.
That circular about
exactly.
The whole quote of it.
Exactly.
So maybe the way to look at it is really just showing, like he wrote Ani first, because Ani is the first character that we hear about, like the first story. So that would be, I mean, I know he says he's a gear, but I feel like we're all dealing until we're living in Eretz Yisrael, and all the avot, and until we made it here, we're all dealing in dealing. Mm-hmm. So I think that rings true with any of them. But if you're looking at Ani, it would really be Yaakov, because he is, his story is just very tragic. I just feel like between him working and his children, and he's obviously, okay, maybe Hashem didn't tell him what happened truly, but like he saw his generations that he worked for. He wants to settle down and just chill out, and he can't because he sees everything deteriorating in front of him. Yitumim would be the next one would be...
And just to add to that, Yaakov, when he does go to meet Pharaoh, he says, my life's been miserable. Na'atzira'im, right, the nation of that my whole life's just been... He wants to settle back in his retirement, play a bit of golf, and just, like, chill out. And that's, I hear that. Good. Okay.
And I feel like there's also, like, what Charlotte and I were discussing, like, last about his whole view of his parents and his mother, like, and just his... I mean,
he's lost everything, right.
He's
lost his past and his future. Right, good. Okay.
So then the next one is Yitom, right? And it says Anim and then Yitom, which would correlate with the second story, which is Yehuda and Tamat.
No, Yitom is orphan.
Right, so I'm saying, though, if you go chronologically, the list that he wrote, then Yitom would be the next.
Yosef is being sold.
Yosef being sold? It's Yaakov, then Yosef.
Then Yehuda Tamar, and then back to Yosef again.
Okay.
So then Yitom fits nicely because Yosef is Yitom. Good, okay, good.
Almanac.
Good.
Or back to it.
Yeah.
And Gam is, again, I mean, I feel like our whole story as Jewish people, like you just said, the whole beginning of the exile and the whole coming back, it all started at this point with Yosef and Yisrael. And it's all, again, it's just the same way that all the Avot are Gerim. So us too, as Jewish people, become Gerim at this point.
we leave our home, we leave Eretz Canaan, we go on a whole kind of very roundabout, you know, journey in order to find out who we are.
And in his quoting, he stresses that the reason we have been led to Gerim is because we were Gerim in Eretz Mitzrayim,
right,
which is exactly Yosef in Eretz Mitzrayim and all that kind of thing. So that's it, some really nice thing. Wow, and now I like that answer as well. So it's not even really Yosef. It's the whole Jewish people.
Yeah,
in
Jewish people.
It's Yosef
like
representing, Yosef, like Mike's Abba, Tim and Labanim, but Yosef in Egypt represents all of us in Egypt. Isn't that nice?
I hate for
Right. Right.
And that's
nice message
that, you know, Hashem will look after all of it.
Right. Right. And it fits the order of the the order in which she presented. Isn't it? Nice. Good. Okay, can you say it?
No, not for that.
I know. I had something I was going to say, I'm scared to say it now because I think it's better.
No, it's okay.
Okay, so I didn't have the benefit of discussing it as a group. So I went off on a weird tangent to try to figure this out. I feel a little bit sorry for Potiphar's wife, to be honest. Because, in a sense, she wanted... I mean, I know that it's portrayed as she was just laughing at him because he was beautiful and that kind of stuff, and Donny Osmond and the musical doesn't really help all that much. But she had a premonition or a vision or something that she was going to marry Yosef, according to the Midrash, that she was trying to, she thought they were meant to, that they were soulmates, that it was supposed to be a shidduch, and in fact she was married to somebody else, and she was trying to overcome all of the challenges. Right? But I can't possibly say that it's Potiphar's wife, because that would mean that Yosef was guilty, and that can't be. But her vision of marrying Yosef was not correct, but it was partly correct, because her daughter married Yosef. In next week's Parsha, in Parsha Miket, it says that Paro gave Yosef Ofnat bat Potipharah as a wife, and that Potiphar is Potiphar, the same person, and Ofnat was her daughter, so that her vision for being part of the Jewish people, Potiphar's wife, wasn't her, and that was a mistake, and that was wrong, and whatever, but that it was her daughter who was supposed to be part of this tradition, and the mother of Menashe and Ephraim. But it actually is more than that, because who was Ofnat? Well, there's different versions of in the Midrash, but Rabbeinu Bechaya says that Ofnat was Dina's daughter. When she was raped by Shechem, she had a daughter, and Yaakov didn't want this daughter around. And so he says, left her in the bush, a snare, which is why she's called Ofnat, because she was found in a snare, in a burning bush. And he had, and Yaakov, the worst things that happened.
Yeah.
It's his, niece, right. That's actually the thing. And Yaakov made a necklace for her which said on it, whoever marries this person is marrying into Yaakov's family. And she kept that hidden, and then after she married Yosef, she showed him.
Ofnat had that.
It
was amazing.
Okay, I know, so don't ask me about the story, but she had that, and then after Yosef married her, Yosef, no one knew who Yosef was either, thought he was some foreigner. So she showed him, Yosef kept it secret, and Rabbeinu Bechaya says that at the end, when Yaakov, in Vayechi, Yaakov brings Menashe and Ephraim to Yaakov for a bracha. Yosef brings Menashe and Ephraim to Yaakov for a bracha before Yaakov dies. And Yaakov says, Mi Eile Lecha. Right, who are these kids? If I can find the right, Ephraim and Menashe. And it says, wait, it's here. One second. It's here. Yeah. So Yaakov sees Menashe and Ephraim, Vaya Yisrael et Bnei Yosef, Vayomer mi Eile, and he says, who are they? Vayomer Yosef el Aviv, and Yosef says to his father, Benai Hem, they're my sons, Ashinatan li Elohim bazit, that God gave me with this. Vayomer Kechan Eli v'Avrochem, and Yaakov says, bring them to me and I'll give them a blessing. Why does Yaakov not know his grandson? That's a really weird thing. And what does it mean, Bazir? Yaakov says, these are my kids that God gave me, Bazir, with this. Really weird word. Right. So, right, Rashi says that he showed him his ksuba to prove that they're really his kids. He showed him that they did a DNA test or something and showed really his kids. But weird. Says Rabbeinu Bahaya, Yaakov is saying, are they really kids that are supposed to be part of Yaakov's family? And Yosef said, yeah, look at this. This is from Dina. From Osnat. This is the necklace you gave her that says that she's part of your family. And therefore these are your grandkids, your great grandkids as well as your grandkids. And therefore it's a Natanim Liba Zer with this thing that he's kept from Osnat that Yaakov gave her. So that's how Rabbeinu Bachai understands this, and Rabbeinu Bachai understands Osnat Pasati Ferah, that Yaakov, that Yosef is marrying Dina's daughter, who's been, and yes, well, I would like to say the poorest person. The poorest person of all the poor people in the whole story is Dina's daughter, who's so poor she doesn't even get her story told in the Chumash, and is completely rejected by her family and sent away and has absolutely nothing, and is adopted by Potiphar and his wife. And who, as part of Yaakov's family, really has no possible future and should be completely assimilated and missed out on everything. And yet she's redeemed at the end, insofar as she ends up fortuitously, like God's there to look out for her and make sure she marries Yosef and becomes the mother of Menashe and Ephraim, who are two of the Shvatim.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there are other stories like that. You could love them.
Yeah, I mean.
And not love them,
love. Love and yeah. Daughters.
It's so strange,
you know. Mm-hmm.
That's
the best. Well, Shem converted. That helps. No, it doesn't help. But all of the stories of the heroes end up with some kind of dodgy skeletons in the closet, and like it is weird. Yeah.
Yaakov has a lot of those, though. I feel like he does have more than Avraham.
More skeletons.
I think that, like, I don't know, last week's parsha to me sounded very sketchy from Yaakov's perspective. I mean. And this week, like what the story that you just said about Osnat, and how the whole story with Shechem, that he kind of made a deal with them. He broke his word. He didn't reprimand his children. The whole stealing, the birthright, there's like a lot of, there's this inconsistency with Yaakov that, I don't know, I just didn't really know about that. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, Yaakov has this good. Part of him is part Esau, he deceived his father, all these things that he's done, the manifestation of the eighth horror through is in these actions, and that actually that Yaakov showed us that you have to use the eighth horror, like it has to be a part of you, use it because for ultimate good. So even though it didn't seem good, like using your daughter's child in the bush or whatever it might be, like there's perhaps some kind of prophetic gift that he's able to know that the results of his actions are ultimately going to be good.
Notwithstanding that, I think the question is a very valid question and a good one to which I don't have an answer. Especially when Yaakov's Mida is Emet. She's an Emet to Yaakov, when you say. That he's supposed to be with the truth. I agree with everything you said.
So maybe that goes back to being
lonely. Low self-esteem. You might have a much worse ebook about it. So that was my thought was that Osnat was poor and was redeemed and given a future. You know, it's just left and abandoned and whatever, and then becomes the future. But I actually like both your two ideas better than mine, so I will leave it on the table, but take a step back and vote for the other two options.
Where's the story about
Osman? Is that on the draft? Or? Yeah. Yeah, but it's in Rabbeinu Bechaya. Since this is Rabbeinu Bechaya, I thought I could cheat and use it to try and explain Rabbeinu Bechaya. But he doesn't actually say that to me. I mean, he says the story, but he doesn't say she's the poor person. Or according to your vision, maybe she's the girl as well. So the most strange of all the strangers. If we're doing it in order.
Where's Dina?
What happened to Dina? Well, she, depending on different versions, she married Shimon according to one.
Where? Shimon.
Her brother, her full brother.
Well, that's
a bit strong.
Yeah, so I don't know. The Torah wasn't given yet, has it?
No, but that's...
It means he protected and looked after her, had her in his house, because she couldn't find the husband after that.
But, I mean, the thing is, if that doesn't make sense, because I don't know who said this, but someone commented on the fact that Yaakov married his sister and then said, oh, the Torah wasn't given yet, which implies that, you know, that's already, like, crazy. So, this seems like Toby is how it happened.
So, I understand that to mean that Levi, that Shimon protected her and looked after and gave her a place to live, rather than he actually consummated a marriage with her. That's, I understand that, but I...
Who says that? Where
does
the idea come
from? Rashi brings it, but it's from Chazal. It's either a Midrash or a Gemara. I can't remember.
What
are the... We have in Shemot and in Bamidbar, I think. No, I'm making it up. It talks about Shaul ben Akhnani somewhere. Help me out, Lee. Somewhere, when it lists the lists all the children and genealogies and names, it's Shaul ben Akhnani.
Oh, yeah.
And Rashi there says that is Dina's son from Shechem, and he's called ben Akhnani because she was, it's her son, rather. And because she was raped by Shechem, who was a Canaanite, that's why it's called Shaul ben Akhnani. But I'm not sure if that son actually was from Shechem or was just because she had that type of Canaanite after that. I don't remember. I'm not sure whether the two Midrashim are compatible or not, but it's a different. Rashi mentions that, and I just can't remember exactly where. So that's what happened to it, and whatever that caused problems later on. So I don't know what happens to you. I don't know, she gets in, she had a rough life. But she is Yosef's soulmate, that's the level. Originally,
Dina
and Yosef are the same person. Leah already had six boys, and then it says that after she had a daughter with Dina, and Rashi there, but the Gemara says she's called Dina because Leah made a din, a cheshbon, and said, I've already got six kids. The two Shvachot have got two kids each. If I have a seventh son, then Rachel can't have more than one. There's going to be 12 altogether. Rachel's only going to have one son. It should be less even than Zilpah and Bilhah. So therefore, there's two different versions of the Midrash. One is that Leah davened and the son that she was carrying turned into a daughter and was Dina. And the son that she should have was Yosef. There's another version which says the angels actually came and switched the embryos in utero, and that Dina, who was conceived, was really Rachel's daughter, and Yosef was really Leah's son, and they were switched. And that somehow their births were born at the same time, at the same thing, and there was a very strong connection between Dina and Yosef. Also Yosef, I suppose, represents Din in a certain sense. More than, but that's to it. The fact that if he married Osnat, who's Dina's daughter, doesn't that immediately become a soulmate? In a sense, it's the other half, literally the other half of himself.
Yeah.
literally, if you can't say literally, then that's false. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Tell it after itself. And that's it. That end. Those are the thoughts. Any other?